The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. Medical implant technology is almost by definition life-saving. It is certainly life-changing in every sense of the word. When there is something seriously wrong with you, or if you've been dealing with a condition that requires constant care, or chronic pain that impacts your life every single day, the idea that there's a device that can help fix it is a godsend, as long as it works. How often do medical implants fail, or even just malfunction and cause more harm than the symptoms they're intended to treat? How thoroughly are these things tested before they're put on the market? And what happens when problems begin to be reported with a device that's already wired into hundreds of thousands of beating hearts around the world? There's a reason you didn't hear about the recall of Sprint Fidelis leads in implanted defibrillators. There wasn't a recall. There were 13 deaths in which the device may have been a contributing factor, though. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Jesse McLean is an investigative journalist at the Toronto Star. He is part of an investigation that spanned the globe, led by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that includes the Star, the CBC, Radio Canada, and more than 50 other news organizations in countries all over the map. What did you realize about medical implants in Canada as you were researching this project?
I had done a lot of research prior to this and reporting into drugs, and I wrongly had assumed that the same type of oversight happens in medical devices. And we really, pretty quickly diving into this, realized how little testing can go into a high-risk device before it's implanted into a human. Originally, we thought that this was going to be like one big global story. And it turns out each country kind of regulates them a little bit differently. Europe is one story. North America, there's similarities between the FDA and Canada, but important differences as well. In Canada, I guess it's important to start that two things. Medical devices covers a gamut. So there's low risk, which is everything from gauze and medical, like surgical masks and things like that, right up to the highest risk, which are things that are implanted in, that connect to the heart, things like that. And so we really focused on these high risk, class 3 and 4, things that are implanted inside bodies. What we learned is, unlike drugs, where any prescription medication that you're going to take generally undergoes randomized controlled trials, so tests in humans, a lot of high-risk devices are never tested in humans before they reach the market. Instead, they're approved based on their similarity to a device already on the market, coupled with some testing in either cadavers or animals, or what's called bench testing, which is kind of like mechanical. So for example, there are these leads, which are these insulated wires that connect the defibrillator, an implanted defibrillator, to the heart in it. Send signals from the heart to the defibrillator, and if there needs to be a shock, it then carries the shock back. And so go back to the early 2000s, and there's this new device hits to market, these things called Sprint Fidelis leads. The first one ever implanted in the world was actually in a London, Ontario operating room. They were promised to be they're thinner, they're better for patients, better for everybody, for surgeons, better for everyone. But it turns out that they were prone to fracture. And when they fractured, the signal there was too much noise, and the defibrillator couldn't read it and would just fire shocks. And so you had people, including this one woman from Seashelt, BC, a coastal community a little bit close to Vancouver. She was lying in bed one night and just got thrown forward. And she saw a flash of white in her eyes, and she's,
oh my God.
First assumption is, I've been struck by lightning. And then she realizes, oh my God, it's my defibrillator. And so she rushes to the hospital, and they check her heart, and they say, no, you're fine. You must have cardiac arrest, and your defibrillator worked. Like, we don't know what happened. So the next few nights, she gets it again. And then when she's at the hospital two or so nights or days later, while hooked up to machines, she gets what's called a firing storm. She gets 6 shots. Bam, 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 bam.
While she's there with doctors watching.
The doctors at this small hospital have no idea what's happening. She's screaming for a magnet to deactivate the defibrillator. They find one. She does it. Gets airlifted to Vancouver. And while the cardiologist is trying to help her again, he inadvertently does something that reactivates it, and she gets another firing storm. In the course of a few days, she gets 18 shocks. And that was one where it's been subject to a lot of lawsuits. And it turns out that the company, months before it was eventually pulled from the market, a U.S. doctor approached them and said, we're seeing a crazy high failure rate in these leads. We have concerns. And then it took another several months before they were pulled from the market. And in that time, this poor woman in Canada had her broken lead removed, and they implanted it with another Sprint Fidelis lead. And so she spent the next 4 years terrified that she was going to get these misfires again.
So that's, first of all, horrifying and insane.
And that device was approved based on bench testing and similarities.
It had never been tested in a person.
It was undergoing test, but its approval So it was undergoing tests in about 160 people around the world, which is a small number when you think of drugs being done in much larger groups. But Health Canada and the FDA both approved it based on evidence not from human trials. The studies were ongoing while these problems were unfolding.
So what are, and this gets to kind of the crux of everything, all the work that you guys did, what are the reporting procedures for devices like this? How does it work when something comes up like this woman gets 18 shocks? What happens next?
In a system where the industry and Health Canada will even say you can't have approvals so burdensome, you can't require so much clinical trials that you dissuade companies from bringing products to market, because then you have people who need products who don't get them.
Right.
These are life-saving devices, and innumerable people have been helped by pacemakers, defibrillators, insulin pumps. Like, I don't want anyone listening to this or reading the articles to say, I'm never getting a medical device. It's what we're trying to do is shine a light on the lack of oversight or flaws in the regulatory system. And so when you have a system that approves devices with sometimes scant scientific evidence, you're putting even more of a burden on the back end, on kind of monitoring once it's on the market. And what we found is that this is a system heavily reliant on the companies that make and sell them themselves. So the only people required by law right now to file an incident report, so when a device may have caused death or injury or had the potential, like a malfunction, the only people required by law right now are companies to file that. There's been legislation that works for a long time to get hospitals, and that should come probably in another year. But so only companies are required. And we found that some companies underreported. So for example, breast implants, one of the largest makers of breast implants, if you look at the past 10 years, it looked like there was no problem. So it'd be maybe two or three this year, five this year, and then one year there was thousands. And that's because they got caught doing these kind of batch type reporting where they're lumping them all into these into a category that made it appear that was designed to report in the US very minor issues. In fact, they were clumping more serious ones in there. And so if you look at Canada, there's this gigantic increase over the past 2 years, and that's just because they got caught and had to report. So that was company underreporting. And we also found thousands of cases of companies late in reporting these required incidents. So, for example, there was 21 deaths that the companies took more than a year to tell the government about.
Meanwhile, other people have these devices in them.
And this is the tool that the government uses to keep track of emerging problems once products are on the market. So if this is what we need this as robust as possible to be able to detect new emerging risk patterns, things like that. And you have companies who are flouting the rules quite dramatically.
Up next.
One element that stunned us was that in the operating room, reps from the companies are often in scrubs present and part of the surgical team.
We all have investment goals, and Scotia iTrade can help you reach yours. Access free tools and resources to sharpen your investment skills. Visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. Scotia iTrade, there's a trader in all of us. So how did this lack of oversight come to be? Because I'm going to put on my stupid person hat for a minute and say a few people got sick and I can't get romaine lettuce anywhere in the country. You can't get it in the United States. I have a small daughter at home. Something went wrong with one of the white noise machines that we have the same model of, and we got an email alert, and there were news stories about this one particular brand of kids' toy. Where do medical implants factor into that? Because it seems insane.
It's a great question. No, and I think that exasperation in your voice is something I've heard from so many of these patients who have had these problems, because there are some high-risk devices that have tracking, but there's a lot. For example, these surgical meshes, a lot of them are implanted through a woman's vagina to either help support organs or help prevent urinary incontinence. These things are kind of these basically interwoven plasticky meshes that can go up inside the body. And people have had a lot of problems with these things. The companies stand by them as safe. Some countries, Australia, for example, has banned them for certain uses. The UK has put a national pause on them because of safety concerns. The FDA in the US has ordered massive safety studies that the companies had to perform. And interestingly, several companies just stopped selling their products once they were required to do that.
Huh.
Canada, our government says the benefits still outweigh the risk. And that, I think, kind of gets in a roundabout way to answer your question. These are products designed to help people.
Yep.
And so for a regulator, they're constantly trying to do this balance. Well, there might be risks. There's a risk with everything. Acetaminophen, Tylenol. If you take too many, very dangerous and almost guaranteed to be fatal. And yet you can buy it everywhere, because when you take the appropriate amount, it's very safe.
Yeah.
So we have to understand that with all devices, all drugs, there is some risk, but it's the balance. Do the risks, are the risks outweighed by the benefits?
Right, but I know acetaminophen or even, you know, amoxicillin or any other kind of drug that I take when I'm sick and need help has been clinically tested in, you know, scientific trials and approved. And it doesn't seem, and I'm not even necessarily blaming the companies themselves for this, because it would seem, you know, anecdotally almost impossible to do clinical level trials of like replacement hips.
Sure. And I mean, they certainly say that. But what some experts, some doctors, some researchers counter that, say, well, hold on. We're not saying put fake hips. Like, you're not comparing it to a placebo. But if you have hip A that's been on the market for 30 years and has an established record, I mean, all hip devices are going to have some level of failure rate.
Yeah.
But it's what's acceptable. You know, is it 1 or 2%? Then that's probably in a ballpark of, okay. Is it 10, 15? That starts to become the trouble. Like, that's a big concern. So these experts say, we're not talking comparing it to a placebo. Why don't you compare it to something that's already on the market? Do a trial and say, all right, you know, these people have device A, which has been on the market for 30 years. We know it's safe. And this newfangled one that's has this new design that promises to be better, this group of people have that. And then we watch them over the years.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you were to require that for approval, it delays access to market. And that's a big concern for industry and for governments who are pressured by industry and patients groups that they want more treatments.
How fast are these devices improving and coming on the market? Because that would seem another obvious thing, right? Like decades ago, you would be looking at largely mechanical stuff. And now technology allows us to implant all sorts of things.
But it's crazy how advanced some of this technology is. It's exceedingly complex. There's a lot of computer components to it. In fact, one element that stunned us was that in part because of how complex these devices are, in the operating room, reps from the companies are often in scrubs present and part of the surgical team.
Really?
So think about that. You're getting your, you know, you, your loved one's getting a hip, and one of the people in the room is probably a device rep. And surgeons who we've talked to and who have been studied say, well, they're an important part of the team because they can help us troubleshoot. They can help us figure out how to assemble this thing correctly.
Oh my God. Troubleshooting in the operating room sounds like a bad enough phrase.
But in some ways, they're seen as this can cut down on problems happening with patients.
Right.
Great. But it obviously raises a concern where you have a relationship struck with this person. You see them all the time. Are you now using this device because you like the rep when another device is more suitable for this patient?
That's something that exists with pharmaceutical companies too.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean, I've written a lot about drug reps going into doctors' offices and promoting kind of, you know, newly approved drugs over old staples and things like that. Back to your question about like how fast these things are coming out. Unlike a drug, so when a drug is a molecule. And if you change it a little bit, it becomes a new molecule and you have to go and get that all approved.
Right.
Devices, you can tinker with them a little bit and kind of re-up your license, often with little new evidence supporting it, scientific evidence supporting
like
it.
Like the new iPhone.
Kind of, yeah. It's a really good comparison. And so I think some experts told us that the general like lifespan of a new device is 18 to 24 months before it's replaced.
Really?
With a new version.
Okay. So they're not even on the market for that long before there's a slightly different version.
Yeah, and that's part of what makes it really hard for the companies.
Yeah.
They have this crazy incentive to always, you know, quote unquote, innovate. And then you have experts say the word innovate or innovation is used way too liberally. A lot of these things are just incremental improvements and really shouldn't be, you know, advertised as innovations in healthcare. One example to tell a story of that so-called innovation is these metal-on-metal hips, which when they came out, they were marketed as like the best new thing in hip replacements. They are seen as more durable and better for people, especially who are like, say, in their 50s or early 60s, who had, you know, another 20 or 30 years of life, and you didn't want to have to get your hip replaced in 15 years.
Yeah.
So you have this stronger one. But there was a bunch of problems with them. In some cases, they weren't. The way they were meant to adhere, they weren't actually adhering. So there's one woman from Toronto, now lives in Creemore, Gloria McSherry. Every day she'd wake up, and the length of her left leg, where she had the hip implant in her left side, would either be a little bit longer or a little bit shorter. Sometimes it would be upwards of an inch longer because it had never actually adhered.
So it's just moving
It's moving. And so she would walk sometimes and it would stop and jar into her and she'd be crippled with pain. And she couldn't go outside when it was too cold because left side would actually seize up. And so she's having a horrible time. And it's not until she goes and consults with a U.S. doctor that she finds out that the company that makes these had actually stopped selling them in the U.S. because safety concerns, but they continued to be implanted in Canada.
How many stories like this did you find? And do you have anything that can kind of illustrate the scope of this problem in Canada?
So no one tracks these. I mean, the government can't even say how many devices are being sold because they can tell you how many have been approved, but some of those might not be being sold anymore. So it's like no one's actually tracking how many are going into people. The companies themselves don't necessarily track who gets their devices. They often just track what hospitals they sold them to. With some exceptions with certain devices, there's very little firm tracking.
So you have to start from the person and go back from the person to the hospital, from the hospital to the company.
You might, yeah. Like, for example, class action lawsuits against these companies, in some cases they've had to go, the companies give them the list of hospitals who they sold them to, and then the hospitals have to dig through their records to notify the patients. And I'm told that some of these hospitals have this in paper form. So you literally have people licking their fingers and flipping through papers to find out who has this potentially problematic device. The scope of it, so we really don't know. This post-market surveillance system, so looking into problems once the devices are approved that we talked about earlier, it's chronically underreported. So it's just really a snapshot, and it's probably just the tip of the iceberg. But in the past 10 years, there have been 1,400 reported deaths. So that's not, doesn't necessarily mean a device caused the death, but it, an incident involving a device.
Yeah.
And another 14,000 injuries in 10 years. And that's, I think all parties agree, probably underreported, so on the low side. We've talked to people with a range of devices, from these vaginal meshes, which were very popular for a while to be implanted, hips, which are, you know, orthopedic devices are the most common, defibrillators, which you hit a certain age and there's a lot of people who have pacemakers or ICDs implanted inside their chest, breast implants, which for either cosmetic reasons or for women who have had mastectomies and things like that,
right,
incredibly popular. So I couldn't actually give you a number in terms of the scope of this, but it is safe to say that it's enormous. There's a lot of seniors with devices, as you could assume, because our health deteriorates. But there's a lot of young people with devices, too. For example, insulin pumps for people with type 1 diabetes. Unlike type 2, which will form can form later in life, these are people who can be born with it. And so there's a lot of young people with these insulin pumps, which, you know, for some have radically improved their lives, but for others have introduced risk, because experts we've talked to say people can become too reliant on these products. And some of them have been associated, at least in the U.S., there's one company whose insulin pumps have been associated with, I think, upwards of 20 recalls or safety notices.
Is there anyone in Canada, I mean, aside from you guys, obviously, that is leading the charge on this, that is offering a better way to do it?
There's a lot of voices, a lot of very smart people. There's patients who have undergone this who are demanding things like a patient registry that would better inform patients when problems happen, arise, because we've talked to several people who didn't learn about safety notices or that the product had been pulled from the market by the company for months or years after. Mm-hmm. So there are people who want this sort of registry that connects so patients know. But then there's also doctors. There's one brilliant pathologist in Toronto who years ago, he noticed that this new device, a heart valve, failed after a few weeks. And in his decades of practice, he had never seen that before. And in a span of a few months, he had seen 8 of these valves fail prematurely within weeks or months of implantation. So he went up to these doctors and was like, guys. And none of them had seen it because they might have done one. Whereas he had connected the dots and seen that there was 8. So he got that hospital stopped implanting them, told Health Canada, told the company. They both basically dismissed him. And that those valves continued to be implanted worldwide for another 2 or so years before they ultimately pulled for safety reasons. He says, look at this story. What would have prevented that? A registry that doctors could look at and put up their problems. Part of the system, too, is a lot of patients don't even know that they can report. And then there's a lot of doctors who might know they can report, but they ultimately report to the company, not directly to Health Canada. And then the companies oftentimes do report to the government, but as we found, thousands of cases where they lagged in those reports.
What's the government reaction been to this story or to this problem in general?
So that's still, as we're talking, kind of percolating. Certainly, this has been part of an international project. Governments around the world have responded saying, for example, in Denmark and Germany and Italy, the health ministers there have said we're at least going to review, if not outright overhaul, our oversight of medical devices. And we're waiting to see. We've still been kind of coming out with the big stories, showcasing the problems. So we're going to be kind of turning our attention to what's the government going to do about it next.
Thanks for shining a light on it.
Thanks for having me.
Jesse McLean, investigative reporter at the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. You can also today visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. Here's some other episodes. Leave us a comment, send us a story idea, or do that on social media at Big Story Podcast, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And of course, we are wherever you get your podcasts. We are on Apple, we are on Stitcher, we're on Spotify, we're on Google. And there is a crazy talented team of people making this podcast. Our producer is Claire Broussard. Our associate producer is Stephanie Phillips. Our other associate producer is Ryan Clark. And Megan Coley is our associate editor and the person talking to you when you email us or hit us up on social media. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk Monday.